ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
The best design? You never notice it. The kettle, the beanbag, the umbrella, they look the way they do because someone somewhere made a decision and that decision stuck. What does that say about them? And what does it say about us? The objects all around you have a story. Hear them on By Design with me, Anthony Burke. Search By Design on the ABC Listen app or wherever you get your podcasts.
This week on The Science Show, a mystery that spans oceans and centuries and includes pirates.
Yes, it's a story that may even lead to Lord Nelson himself. So how do researchers piece together an artifact's history?
We'll also discover why the famously enigmatic echidna has such a big brain.
And how the impact of a forest road doesn't stop at its edges. Even dirt tracks can be disastrous for ecosystems and the poor beings that live within them. I'm Robin Williams.
And I'm Belinda Smith. Robin, I love a mystery. So when an archaeologist told me about an intriguing sword he'd recently acquired, well, I had to investigate. And it turns out that some of the most famous and infamous figures in maritime history, including feared Southeast Asian raiders and Admiral Lord Horatio Nelson, may have once brandished this very sword. And it looks like it would be right at home in the hands of a pirate. Take it from the archaeologist who originally got in touch with me, Professor Adam Brum.
I remember my brother saw it and he goes, oh my God, this thing looks like the bad guys in G.I. Joe. It looks like one of the sort of weapons that they would use, or an orc from Lord of the Rings. It's a fearsome looking and very exotic to Western eyes, a very exotic looking object. You would probably liken it to a, I guess what we would call a broadsword.
But this is not your typical broadsword.
So it's like a wavy, flame-like blade.
With curved, undulating edges, like a slithering snake.
The base of the blade, just before it meets the hilt, is elaborately and flamboyantly crafted into a type of handguard and has a hilt with this hemp binding around it and an elaborately carved pommel that's in the shape of a cockatoo head.
Wow.
And it's, yeah, when you hold it in your hand, it has a really good feel to it and a good weight, and it just feels quite like you can do some serious damage with this sword.
You weren't tempted to throw a potato in the air and try to cut it on the way down?
I would, but unfortunately the handle, like, has a wooden hilt beneath the hemp fiber wrapping, and it's fractured at some point. So the handle is a little bit fragile, so you have to handle it very carefully. No fruit ninja-like activities, unfortunately, with this old warhorse.
This old warhorse of a sword is an example of a kris. It's considered a cultural symbol of Indonesia and some surrounding countries. But what really got Adam excited about this kris sword was not its wavy blade, nor its intricate carving work, but faded ink on a paper label stuck on its wooden sheath.
So it says, a poison kris, a present from the something of Timor to Admiral Lord Nelson.
Mm.
Okay, so a couple of important points there. First of all, the reference to it being a poisoned kris is quite interesting because in early European colonists were fascinated by these objects when they encountered them in Indonesia and Malaysia and the southern Philippines. And they brought back with them to Europe all of these stories about these deadly-looking curved blades having an insidious poison, such that even the slightest scratch from one of those kris blades would be enough to kill you almost instantly. And then the mention of it being a present from the something of Timor to Admiral Lord Nelson is interesting. I mean, Timor is a island in Southeast Asia, not that far from Australia. So apparently this object came from Timor itself or from someone who was connected to Timor. And then, again, the mention to the reference to it being a present for Admiral Lord Nelson is just bizarre. But look, I've been doing as much research as I can into the story of this object and the inscription, trying to make sense of it.
I mean, you are a scientist.
I am a scientist. I'm used to dealing just with stone tools up to a million years old and things like that. But dealing with an inscription like this and a reference to this famous historical figure, this is kind of a first for me, but it's really exciting. And I've just been obsessed with getting to the bottom of it.
Even before getting his hands on the Chris sword from a collector in Brisbane a few years ago, who had actually picked it up from a gun show in the late 80s or early 90s, Adam's been an avid collector of Chris. Most Chris are smaller, like daggers, many with that distinctive wavy blade and intricate carving. And they do generally look like they could cause harm, but many ethnicities in Indonesia consider the Chris to be more of a ceremonial or spiritual object than a weapon. Each ethnic group has a slightly different style of Chris, and they're highly prized, often given as gifts. And while Chris swords retain the artisanal metalwork and carvings of the daggers, they weren't made just to be ceremonial objects. They were for killing.
Yes, this is a distinctive sword Chris of the Moro people, and they are essentially a loose confederacy of Muslim groups inhabiting the Islamic southern Philippines, primarily focused on the island of Mindanao and the Sulu archipelago between the Philippines and Borneo. And in historical times, they were notoriously feared, formidable pirates and maritime raiders. They were essentially like the Vikings of island Southeast Asia.
And their primary targets? The Spanish, who from the 1500s conquered the Philippines and then tried to subjugate Moro territory to their rule. But the Moro fought back fiercely.
They were known to descend on lone Spanish galleons or Spanish-controlled coastal settlements in these huge fleets of fast-moving ships and just lay waste to them, basically. Cause chaos, this sort of hit-and-run tactic that sometimes would be up to 100 individual boats, maybe 1,000 or so of these warriors, and they would just spill out and just steal all the gold, capture as many people as possible and carry them away as slaves. They resisted the Spanish colonial Spaniards for centuries, and the Spanish were never able to conquer them, essentially.
And Chris swords were one of their classic weapons.
They had a whole array of bladed weapons, spears, swords of all kinds, but this sword Chris is a distinctive weapon of the Moro that they would use when they were boarding ships. The colonial Spanish were never really able to curtail their raiding activities until probably the late 1800s when they got hold of steam-powered warships.
Mm.
And in fact, the Americans were still fighting them. When Spain ceded the Philippines to the Americans at the end of the 19th century, the US colonial administration faced the same problems that the Spanish had. They were trying to bring the Moro lands under the control of America, and the Moro weren't having it. And they followed the so-called Moro Rebellion, which was about a 10-year war stretching between 1903 to 1913. And the Americans fought the Moro, and they had huge problems fighting them. And in fact, up close, an individual Moro warrior, although they often didn't have guns, they would just charge the American soldiers in the jungle armed with their Chris and other weapons like that and killed a lot of them. You know, they were, yeah, very, very difficult to defeat in close combat. So much so that it's said that the American army, after the experience of fighting the Moro with these Chris, they actually developed a more powerful sidearm, you know, like a pistol that the soldiers would carry.
Wow.
Because they needed a gun that could stop, you know, an enemy in their tracks, because once these guys got up close to you with their weapon, it was all over. That was essentially the origin of the iconic 45 caliber pistol that sort of revolutionized sidearm technology in the 20th century. So it was the experience of fighting these pirates and raiders that really changed the American style of warfare for sure.
So Adam's Chris sword could have been wielded by a feared Moro raider as they resisted conquistadors in the seas around the Philippines. But if you believe the faded label on its sheath, it also belonged to another seagoing fighter. Vice Admiral of the White Horatio Nelson, 1st Viscount Nelson, 1st Duke of Bronte. We'll just call him Nelson. So who was Nelson?
I've always, of course, been aware of Nelson. He's unavoidable in this country. I mean, every major town has some memorial to him.
This is Martin Downer. He was a dealer at Sotheby's in London and is an expert in Nelson and Nelson's artefacts.
There are very few British historical figures that command an international attention. And I suppose you might put Nelson, Churchill, perhaps, latterly Princess Diana, I suppose. But there are only a handful of British figures from history that have a recognition outside this country. And Nelson, for someone who was living in the 18th century, he traveled across the globe from India to Canada, South Africa, of course, around Europe a lot. So he was extraordinarily well traveled by the nature of his career, but also the nature of his life and his death still commands fascination from people.
Nelson's whole career was in the Navy. He joined in 1771 at the tender age of 12 and quickly rose through the ranks to have command of his first ship at 20 years old. Now, Nelson was, by all accounts, a brilliant tactician. His strategies were bold, unconventional, non-traditional, and they took his enemies by surprise. But Nelson did meet his end at the age of 47 when he was shot by a French sniper during the Battle of Trafalgar in 1805. The British Navy won that battle. It was perhaps the nation's greatest naval victory, crushing Napoleon's plans to invade Britain. But Nelson did not survive. His body was put in a barrel of brandy and brought back to England, and he's been recognised as a national hero ever since.
So he's endlessly studied and endlessly written about, and objects that he touched are fought over by collectors. He cultivated a cult of a celebrity around himself. He was very keen to project his likeness to the public through print culture and portraiture. But because he was so famous in the last years of his life, everyone retained his letters. So if he had a letter from Nelson, he would keep it.
And Nelson wrote a lot of letters. We're talking more than 5,000 that we know of. How he found the time between winning so-called unwinnable battles, and especially after he had to teach himself how to write with his left hand after losing his right arm at the age of 38, it really is something.
As such, his letters are extraordinarily large, the archive of surviving documents relating to Nelson and to the people around him, which means that he's probably one of the figures from the 18th century that we can study most because we have the most sources for him. That too has helped to fuel the industry around him to this day.
Aside from all these letters that he wrote, after he died in 1805, did he leave lots of stuff behind?
He did. He left his possessions and his estate in a degree of chaos.
And that's partly because his life in general was in a degree of chaos, and not without scandal. Nelson didn't have any children with his wife, but he did have one with his mistress, Emma Hamilton, who was married to another bloke as well. So when Nelson died,
he had no legitimate heir, so his affairs were dealt with by his older brother, William, who was a rather distasteful character and a greedy man. And there was a huge battle over objects belonging to Nelson. So Emma Hamilton sought to secure as much as she could, and the brother tried to get as much as he could. Emma Hamilton had a series of auctions, and many objects belonging to Nelson were dispersed at those auctions in the early 19th century. And as a consequence, Nelson's possessions were scattered to the four winds, really, which is good for me because 200 years later, I can still find them hidden around the place.
Nelson's vast trove of letters and other documents helped people like Martin figure out if a hat or a medal or a wavy bladed sword did indeed once belong to the man, which would make it very valuable to collectors.
You stumble across little clues scattered across the landscape of Nelson's correspondence, and then you sort of start pulling at it, and sometimes you find a thread that leads you somewhere else, or sometimes you go and hit a dead end.
Martin's been pulling on these threads for decades, so he was the perfect person for Adam to email when it came to figuring out if his Chris sword was a genuine Nelson artefact.
My first thoughts were those of scepticism, really. Nelson had spent 2 years in the East Indies as a very young officer in the 1770s. That's the closest he came to sailing in those waters. But there was no reference to such a piece in his collection. It was such an extraordinary object to connect to a British officer of that date when contact with that part of the world and England was so scarce. However, after a bit of thought, it grew on me as an object that seems so outrageous to be true that it probably is true, because the labelling on the piece is very compelling. And in my experience, objects that try to be something that they're not or try to display a history that they don't have tend to be more obvious. So, for instance, if you were going to attempt to deceive someone with an object belonging to Nelson, you'd probably do something that you'd expect Nelson to own, like a naval hat or a medal or something.
No.
Something that obviously would be connected to someone of his type at that date. So to have this extraordinary foreign-looking object associated with him is in itself convincing to me.
But what really convinced Martin was when Adam brought the sword over to England.
The best way of working with an object is actually to handle it, because the object itself can, to a degree, speak to you. If you're familiar with handling objects, it's hard to describe, but you get a kind of innate sense of something that feels right or wrong. And this object, when it came to England last year, handles compellingly, handles as something that is right. There's no doubt that the object is what it purports to be, a late 18th century weapon of that region. And the labelling on it is also worded in a correct way. There's a lot to it that just feels right.
So, for instance, the label refers to Lord Nelson, which helps narrow down the time at which the Chris sword was given. Nelson didn't become Lord Nelson until 1798, and he died in 1805. So Martin suspects it was probably gifted around 1802 to 1803. And a Moro Chris sword being an appropriate gift to someone like Nelson? Well, that makes sense too.
I know, having read around the subject quite extensively, meeting Adam, that was a weapon at the time that was of the very best type, and it was a fearsome weapon to use at sea or on land, and was a weapon that was often employed by the pirates in the region, by high-status members of the community. And so if a weapon was going to be gifted to Nelson from that region, this is the weapon that it would be.
So far, Martin's not found mention of the Chris sword in any letters or painted into any portraits. In fact, Martin's not aware of any other Southeast Asian artefacts in Nelson's belongings. So he's really just going on clues from the label and his feelings after decades in the business. But if it did belong to Nelson,
it leaves the question of how the weapon travelled so far to Nelson. But interestingly enough, when I was working on the piece, I found that Matthew Flinders did call in at Timor in 1802 before he circumnavigated Australia.
1802. That fits Martin's potential timeline.
And he had served with Nelson. I mean, he was an officer and his ship also had served with Nelson.
So maybe on his way over here to Australia, Matthew Flinders picked up the Chris sword in Timor to take back to his old colleague in England.
You know, we're building up a plausible explanation, a plausible moment in time when this weapon could have been received by an officer, a Royal Naval officer, and transported by gift to Nelson. So there are lots of pieces of the jigsaw which are on the table at the moment, some of which join up, and slowly but surely we're building up that picture.
Another part of that picture is the Chris sword's journey from England to Australia. To that end, Adam Brum discovered one of Nelson's nephews actually emigrated to the New South Wales colony in 1828, and maybe he brought the sword with him.
So that would provide a potential way of explaining how the object itself got to Australia. But, you know, and on the other hand, these historical objects, they can find their way all over the world. That's not crucial to explain how it got to Australia, but it certainly would help to make sense of it.
From there, well, that leaves more than 150 years between it potentially arriving at Australia and the next solid time point in its history, which was a Brisbane gun show in the late 80s or early 90s, where it was bought by the bloke who Adam then bought it from. Who had it during those intervening decades is, at the moment, a mystery. But right now, the Chris sword is in a safe in London as Martin continues searching for something that might nail it as a genuine Nelson artefact. And if he does, it could be worth serious cash. One of Nelson's swords fetched more than £330,000 at Sotheby's in 2002. That was a little under $1 million Australian at the time. What do you hope will happen to the Chris?
If we do manage to find some sort of evidence that this belonged to Lord Nelson, it becomes then one of these national treasures of Britain and of English history. But on the other hand, it's clearly been in Australia for a very long time.
Mm.
So then it becomes an object of interest for Australia and our history as well. And but then also it was, you know, it's an artifact, cultural artifact of the Moro people originally.
Mm.
I mean, look, I've often imagined that this belonged to a notorious or a famous Moro pirate, for example, and it was captured from this figure, and it might have been one of the most feared figures in that region, and was seen as a fitting gift from one lord of the sea to another. Surely just some rough and tumble pirate's cutlass wouldn't have been of much of a fitting present to give to one of the most famous people in the world at that time. So I suspect that there's a interesting story behind this Moro artifact itself and its original owner. And so that also raises the, well, this is then an object that is part of the cultural heritage of the Moro people as well. So yeah, it's a interesting one there, Belinda. And it also, I mean, look, it's, you know, the object itself could be over, well over 200 years old, and it had, there's conservation issues. So it really belongs in a museum of some kind, that's for sure. But where, I really don't know at this stage.
And if a connection to Nelson proves elusive?
Well, look, you know, so far we've been just focusing on the historical sources, but if I can get it back to Australia, I'd really like to start to science the hell out of it, you know, like start to analyze the label. There's all sorts of scientific studies that we could do that might help to get to the bottom of it.
So it might be possible to figure out when the kris was made by using carbon dating. You could use perhaps wood from the handle or the sheath, and maybe even extracting tiny pieces of charcoal from the metal, which would have been trapped in there when the blade was forged. It's also possible to try to link the kris with Nelson using DNA. In theory, anyone who picked up the sword over the centuries may have some of their DNA lodged in the hemp fibre that's around the hilt. And this could be extracted and analysed.
You know, and frankly, this is just the sort of thing that I love. I love a mystery to work on as an archaeologist and really as a scholar. And to me, this is one of the most enigmatic objects I've really come across.
Professor Adam Brum from Griffith University. His archaeological work in Indonesia in particular has helped reconstruct ancient human migrations in the region, including Australia.
And it's a history of human occupation that stretches back further in time as more evidence comes to light. We covered that in last week's Science Show, when we also noted how some of our animals had been maligned as leftovers of evolution by overseas so-called experts. Even the platypus was described, okay, in the 19th century, as a fake. Well, now the platypus's relative, the echidna, is celebrated as exceptional in a new book by Dr. Danielle Claude of Adelaide. I went to the launch in Sydney.
We're standing actually in a pub in Darlinghurst. It's the last place you might imagine you'd see an echidna, but I know Danielle Claude, author of The Enigmatic Echidna, that within 300 metres from where we're standing, there are at least a couple of echidnas. Do you know?
Echidnas turn up in the most unlikely places, I have to say. There are certainly some nearby.
I'm pointing to the Australian Museum. And they're no longer thriving echidnas, but your book is a delight in all sorts of ways, and there's so many puzzles about it. Now, let's start off at the beginning, when I don't suppose they're really born. They've got a pouch, and out of the cloaca comes an egg. How does the egg know how to get into the pouch? How does that work?
They are really remarkable. I guess echidnas, it hatches outside, whereas for the rest of the mammals, it hatches inside.
It hatches outside, but it has to get somehow into the pouch, does it not?
That's been a great mystery for many, many, many years, how that happens, because, of course, marsupials crawl when they're born, but echidnas, being in an egg, can't crawl, so they need a bit of help, and it's clearly the mother who helps with her snout. Just she curls up when she lays the egg and directs the egg up into a very shallow pouch on her belly. It's more like a fold.
But going back a step, for fertilisation, when mother to be is strolling along, there's a male train. How does she select out of that train of 3, 4, 5 males?
It's a tricky thing to know what a female echidna's thinking when she's choosing a male, but she does make her choice in the end, and I think it's probably got to do with stamina and staying power, the one who follows her the longest. And also, they have a courtship, so there's much stroking and pacifying going on, and eventually she agrees to the deed.
How do you stroke something with all those barbs? And indeed, you've got no hands to use it.
Well, actually, the spines on the echidna are very responsive. If you ever touch an echidna, you know they can feel the lightest touch with their spines.
You said, what is it thinking? What is she thinking? Now, one of the greatest surprises about your book is the description of the big brain that these creatures have. And the question is, why do they need a big brain? It's very puzzling.
It is really puzzling. It's quite a large brain for their body size, and it's also wrinkly like ours, which suggests it's got a lot of cortical matter on the outside. And the forebrain, the thinking, what we use for executive thinking and strategic thinking and planning, that part of an echidna brain is very large, and we really don't know what they use it for, because all the things we think intelligence is used for being social, for hunting, for raising young, all these sorts of things, are not things echidnas do.
But you give the clue in your book, and you mention, for instance, some birds like Betty the Crow, one of my favourite birds, coming from the South Pacific. And the great thing about the South Pacific, there are very few predators for Betty the Crow, and so she can teach her offspring how to use little bits of razor wire that you get from the edge of a leaf, put it down a little hole, and there you found your dinner. In other words, a little worm there. So the brain might enable you to find food you cannot see, but to work out where it might be.
Certainly, searching for hidden food is something that's sometimes associated with large-brained animals, although there's lots of other anteaters that are finding the same food and they don't have large brains. So there's still something else going on as well. And I suspect it probably has to do with their long life and the fact that they need to learn a lot about their environment in order to survive and remember it. So I think perhaps it's got to do with memory.
Yeah. Lots of people coming to your party, which is about to be launched. You've already launched in Adelaide, but the launch is in a few minutes here, and I can understand why it's such a frolicsome book. Talking about frolics, the thing that really amused me, and indeed one of your fine criticisms in the Australian Book Review, he said he loved most of all the idea of the way it climbs up to a little hill, goes into a ball, and then rolls down. You can just imagine going, wee, playing.
It's an unusual observation, but it was observed at the Desert Springs Park in Alice Springs, and the keepers described the young echidna doing this. So we don't observe echidnas in the wild very much. So there's lots of things going on that we perhaps don't know about.
Well, talking about observing, one of my greatest surprises seeing an echidna, the most recent one for me, is down the south coast in the Shoalhaven, on the beach. This creature, I thought it was a dog in the wrong place, because you're not supposed to have dogs there because of the birds, the special birds there. And it's just strolled out, easy as you like, looking round. It didn't smile and wave, but almost that sort of thing, as if it was so being casual. What was it doing on the beach?
They're really quite aquatic. They're obviously descended from aquatic animals, because their nearest relative is the platypus, and they seem to have a lot of residual aquatic traits. And they're really very comfortable in water, surprisingly so. We think of them as an arid land creature, but in Orpheus Island, they swim around the islands and between the islands. We've had one been eaten by a shark, so, you know, they've been seen foraging in the water on Kangaroo Island. So they're really very adaptable creatures, and they're very good swimmers.
And you've been around Australia and elsewhere in pursuit of them. Where haven't you been to look for them?
Well, you've always got your eye out for an echidna when you're travelling. You know, why wouldn't you? Because they are found everywhere. They're found up in the Snowies. They're found in the Kimberleys. I have to say I've more often not found an echidna than actually found one, and that's one of the characteristics of them, is that they're really hard to find despite the fact that they're found all over the country. It's always a thrill when you do see one, I think. They're a little bit magical like that.
And if you take it home and settle down, think you've got a nice bit, suddenly it escapes. It's an escape artist as well.
They are incredibly difficult to keep in captivity, and early explorers certainly found that when they tried to hang on to them and they just find that they vanished. So,
and they're incredibly strong. Was it your fridge it moved?
No, it was not my fridge. I'm not sure which fridge that was, but I've certainly seen them moving large rocks that were bigger than them. So they're incredibly strong animals. They're very powerful.
One turned up on our steps, stone steps, down the south coast. And I thought, oh, gosh, I wonder if it's got lost. And what I'll do is I'll lift it up and put it somewhere else. I could not lift it. It must have had suction feet or something. It's unbudgeable.
They're absolutely unbudgeable. When they want to go, they go. And when they don't want to go, you can't move them. So that's a really well-known characteristic of them. But the interesting thing is an echidna always knows where it needs to be. Chances are it's quite happy where it is. So as long as it's not in any danger, they're best off left to their own, find their own way.
And they live a long time, so do they make social parties, groups of them, or do they stay fairly solitary?
They're generally regarded as pretty solitary, but there are some slightly inexplicable reports of aggregations of them being found from time to time, so we're not quite sure what's going on there. But by and large, they're fairly solitary. I expect their food keeps them distant from one another.
So. How long did it take you to write this book? It's got so much in it.
About a year to 18 months, I'd say. This one took a little bit longer than some of my books.
But the research, years, I would have thought.
It is a lot of research. I'm getting very good at it now.
What?
So it is a lot of research, but I do obviously have a lot of help from the scientists who've spent their lifetime working on these animals. So I couldn't have done it without people like Stuart Nicol and Peggy Rismiller and all of the work that they've done.
Well, lots of people are beginning to turn up, so I love the book. I wish it luck, of course. Congratulations.
Thank you so much. It's always lovely to talk to you about books.
Dr. Daniel Claude and the Enigmatic Echidna, published by Black Books, is available now and brilliant.
So, Robin, just before, you mentioned Betty the Crow. Remind me again, what was so special about her?
Very, very intelligent and also biggish brain.
Mm-hmm.
Bird brains can be. And she had a big brain, it's suggested by zoologists, because she was looking for hidden food. In other words, you've got to be smart enough to find out that under the dirt or down a hole in a tree, there's dinner and you can look for it and even teach your kids how to find it.
Maybe we should use bird brain as a compliment these days because, of course, in Sydney, you've got cockies that can find leftover food or hidden food in wheelie bins, and so they'll flip the lid. And they've also learnt to turn on water bubblers so they can get to the fresh water that comes out of them. It's quite amazing. And I remember talking to a cognitive ecologist about this, and the hypothesis behind this is called the cognitive buffer hypothesis. So it's the same idea as what Danielle was talking about. If you've got a long life, odds are that the environment around you will change. So you need a big brain to adapt to those changes, whether that's in a forest or in an urban environment like a cocky.
And you can learn your tricks from your mates and even teach it to your kids.
That's right.
And this is The Science Show on ABC Radio National. Something that can hasten environmental change is a simple dirt track. Far too many roads are now being planned to slice destructively through the world's ancient forests. And at James Cook University in Cairns, distinguished Professor Bill Lawrence is warning of the consequences.
Here you are, based in northern Queensland, and you spend so much of your time travelling right round the world, far distant places. Why that?
Well, I think because we work on tropical rainforests, which of course are some of the most imperiled and most biologically rich ecosystems on the planet. And one of the things that we really see is that many of the areas where there's the most rapid and alarming forest destruction happening are in developing nations. So we can talk about New Guinea, we can talk about the Amazon, talk about the Congo Basin, we can talk about Southeast Asia. Those are all places where we work, and all places that, quite frankly, are just undergoing extraordinary and in some cases, in many cases, very concerning development. And I think you'd have to broadly classify as unsustainable development, just given the onslaught of what's happening in a lot of these places.
When you go there and you see something being developed and you say to people, the minute you put a road in, you've changed it completely, they don't necessarily register Rhodes as being that important. Do you have that sort of impression now and then?
Absolutely. I think a lot of people don't really think about the broader effects and implications of Rhodes. But one of the things that we see again and again is just the extraordinary nature of what happens when a road goes into a relatively intact, undisturbed tract of forest, and you tend to get rapid colonization, invasions of land grabbers. You see illegal logging activity. We see huge amounts of illegal gold mining in many places. There's poaching. The people that come in, the gold miners and others that tend to come in, oftentimes are pretty sort of rough characters, and they tend to dominate local indigenous groups and local residents. There's big increases in prostitution and various kinds of communicable diseases. I mean, the impacts go on and on. Unfortunately, I think many people just hear the word road and they think, oh, progress, that's good. And we need roads, let's face it. I mean, we need to have roads. But the point is that some of these roads are just in the wrong places and they're just having a calamitous impact.
Isn't there sufficient, after all this time, understood of that sort of effect as the decades, possibly centuries pass, that people are given good warning that what they're doing doesn't work?
Yeah, you would like to think that. Perhaps people hear this stuff and they just sort of discount it or whatever. I'm not really sure, but I can just tell you that if you had to pick a single thing that was the biggest direct threat to ecosystems around the planet, around the world, you'd have to say roads. And again, roads have advantages, and they're there for a reason sometimes. But for instance, the International Energy Agency estimated that we're going to have about 25 million kilometers of new paved roads by the year 2050. And that's enough to go around the world more than 600 times. That's the rate at which we're building roads right now. It's extraordinary, especially in many developing countries, but in industrial countries as well. So we really have our work cut out for us. And we're not against economic growth. We're not against long-term development. We're just really trying to advocate for a more sustainable approach, which we think is going to have big benefits both for nature and for people.
So when you go there to study as scientists what's going on and the effect, or are you there to argue a case perhaps as well?
We sometimes do both. It depends on the forum and that situation, but we certainly have been involved over the years in many different conservation issues. And oftentimes we tend to focus on fairly specific issues. We might say, well, deforestation is bad. We all know this. But let's say, for instance, there's this new 500-kilometer long highway that's going to go right through the heart of Borneo or right through the heart of the Amazon. That's the kind of project we would really try to have an impact on. And we could do things like we have meetings with prime ministers and with their cabinets. I've testified before various congresses. We really do try to engage, and in a constructive way. Again, we're not trying to blame people. We're not trying to point fingers. We're trying to say, look, here's some smart things that you can do to have better development than maybe what's happening right now.
But their horizon surely is maybe the next election cycle, 3, 4 years, 5 years, whereas yours is decades.
That's a big problem, and it's absolutely right. And you know, also, if you talk about corporations, I mean, they operate on quarterly profit statements. I mean, so, you know, the dynamics that affect them are really important. One of the things that we've tried to do is to try to connect what we do with politics and with getting elected. And we've oftentimes said to leaders, look, if you follow these kinds of pathways, they'll be much more sustainable, they'll be economically smarter, there'll be a lot of benefits, and we think this will translate into actual votes and getting you reelected. And we have really found, when we're talking with these kinds of leaders, the words votes and money, both are words that they actually, you know, they will wake up and suddenly they're paying attention. We do very much find that we have to translate our language into something closer to their language because they have their own way of thinking about things.
Who's doing well? I've heard that Costa Rica has been in the past anyway quite good.
Yeah, it varies. For instance, Indonesia has had recent drops in deforestation in the last couple of years. Costa Rica, yes, for sure. The Amazon, I think you could probably, Brazilian Amazon, you'd probably say, although deforestation rates have fallen, there's so many new big projects happening there. Congo Basin, very bad. Parts of New Guinea, not too bad. Other parts are of concern. So it's a specific thing. It depends where you're looking. In some cases, it's certain specific parts. A region might be getting very much hammered, and then there's a concern that that's going to then proliferate and spread much more widely.
As a scientist yourself personally, are you looking at the botany or the animals or what? Both?
Yeah, we try to look at everything, essentially. We look at the carbon storage that's in the forest. We look at the impact of the forest on the regional hydrology and the climate. We certainly look at the birds and the mammals and the frogs and the insects, too, and enjoyed that very much. But we also work on trees and vines and other things. So kind of everything is what we work on. And I think in some ways that gives us a bit of an advantage in that we don't come into this with a real specific narrow focus, a narrow silo, like some people might do. I think we do tend to look at things very broadly, and I think that's probably appropriate.
What's your next project as we sit here? Where are you heading?
Just 3 weeks, we're going up to Papua New Guinea, and we have a project up there. It's a new project that we're just starting up, and we're working in an area that's the largest conservation area in Papua New Guinea, so it's over 200,000 hectares in area, and it's about 20,000 people that live there, so there's a lot of, the area that we're looking at has a bunch of different groups, a lot of hunting going on, and then there's loggers and miners and others are very much wanting to get into this area. So we've got funding from the European Union to go and try to help build up monitoring of biological diversity in the area. And one of the key points is they're hoping to eventually get some kind of income stream for these communities so there could be some economic benefit. Mm. That might be tourism or it could be a variety of different other things.
Way back, I used to come across a person called Johnny Wyko, who actually was involved with forests. And whenever I said something idealistic about what they could do to stop the way that the forests are being exploited, he said, it's not going to happen. He was fairly determined. Sad, but is it still without necessarily much hope there?
Well, you know, I think conservationists, and I certainly consider myself a conservationist, have kind of learned the hard way that we've been dooming and glooming and talking about how bad everything is for such a long time that I think we've realized that we've started to kind of lose and alienate our audience, which is all that broad community out there. So when we talk about nature conservation, I think a lot of us are now saying we have to have hope. We have to give examples where there's been successes. We have to identify the paths forward. We need to think about how there can be broad benefits for nature. And so I think that's the mindset that a lot of people are trying to adopt now. Now, is that easy and is it realistic? You know, Robin, I'd probably have to say that there are many cases, many, many situations where it's not very good. The situation is not very good. There's a reason why people are so worried about the tropical rainforest, a very good reason. I think there's been enough successes now that we can't paint this a single color. It's got to be more of a mosaic of colors, and there's going to be dark colors where we failed and haven't done well, and bright colors and lots of vivid things happening in areas where we have had some success.
Good luck.
Thank you. We need it.
Distinguished Professor Bill Lawrence at James Cook University, where science thrives in the tropical north. As some of our universities bounce through the challenges of money and protocol, others are emerging with glowing optimism. One is, at last, the University of Wollongong, just noted as number 12 on the national list of achievers. The new Vice-Chancellor is Professor Max Liu, who has a fine reputation both as a material scientist and a safe pair of hands, as they say. Now he's published a paper on one of our major national debates, energy and productivity, and actually writes that we in Australia could, with the right policies, become a world leader.
Are you still researching yourself at the bench?
No, unfortunately, I stopped. But I'm forever being curious, and I do read the latest literature in the area of, say, for example, hydrogen storage, hydrogen production, and to keep abreast, so to speak, you know, what's happening at the frontier of my field, but really enjoy listening to some of the young scientists talking about it. For example, we have here at the University of Wollongong, you know, so fortunate to have a large number of scientists like Gordon Wallace, Jerry Swiggers, who Jerry in particular, he started this company called Hysata. Hysata is a remarkable startup company, only about 4 or 5 years old, and they are now on the way to produce the best electrolyzers in the world to produce cheap green hydrogen.
Now, you mentioned Gordon Wallace before, and of course, 3D printing of body parts, which is still going on the innovation campus across the highway here, which is incredible work. But hydrogen, you've written about in your paper just published about the future of energy, really, for the whole country. And I thought hydrogen was a bit low-key at the moment because of the financial considerations, because the chief scientist, Alan Finkel, was extremely fond of it as technology, but the market didn't back it up.
Yeah, Alan and I go a long time back. Both of us share the passion for hydrogen. Hydrogen is a clean energy carrier. It's not the energy source, but it still has a huge potential. Only if when the policy, investment community and industry and then research community aligned. And this is something that I highlighted in that article that I recently published. For us to be a leader, we need to coordinate at the national level, at the state level, policy in terms of major project approvals and planning, national investment in the infrastructure, as well as R&D and industry deployment. So we have some good examples of things happening. Hesata, as I mentioned, is one of those examples. And they are a startup company, but they work very closely with many energy companies. And the Australian government has recently invested via the Australian Research Council Centre of Excellence. I think the total investment is $73 million to really support researchers at the forefront of hydrogen and alternative fuel development to develop the cutting-edge solutions for some of the technologies involved in hydrogen, for example.
May I ask you about that? Because you mentioned that you've got on campus a brilliant new way of doing it. Of course, the traditional way is to use, if you like, electrolysis. Old-fashioned, we used to do it in labs at school, and you get hydrogen coming out and a couple of other things like water. But the trouble is that when you've got to provide energy to get it out, sometimes you use more energy than you actually yield. And another problem is the transport of the hydrogen. Some people suggest that ammonia would be a good way to transport it as well. So how are you solving those sorts of problems, do you think?
There are two problems you identified. One is the production side, and then the other one is the storage and transport. So in terms of the production, the mature technology is electrolysis, as you mentioned. However, the traditional way of splitting water by electrochemistry, the electrolyzer, only works to about 60-65% efficiency. So that means that there are still about 30-35% of the energy lost. So now scientists, and particularly those scientists who work in catalysis and electrocatalysis, trying to improve the technology of electrolysis. And Jerry Swiggers, Jerry has come up with a brand new technology to split water. And that's why the Hesata's technology has been demonstrated in megawatts scale already. And there's a huge, huge pipeline of orders come from overseas for Hesata's technology. They can reduce cost to be below $2 per kilogram, which is the holy grail target that's going to be commercially viable. It's going to beat the first generation or second generation electrolysis technology that is available now by a large margin. So that's the production. Storage, I think the challenge for hydrogen transport lies in how are you going to store hydrogen safely in large quantities. So there are many competing technologies now. The mature technology is compression. So you compress the gas, hydrogen gas, in a bit of denser gas, in a high pressure cylinder. And that still is the prevalent technology, but I think there are safety concerns. If you put this on the vehicle, for example, even though some of the buses, fuel cell buses, are running on hydrogen using compressed tanks. But if passengers use this in their back of their car, they might be concerned. So therefore, there is a new frontier. It's called solid state adsorbent that would store hydrogen. And this is an area that I worked for many years before, when in my heydays as a scientist. So we developed a patented technology that can store enough percentage, enough weight, enough quantity of hydrogen under very low pressure. So almost atmospheric or 2 bar instead of 600 or 700 bar. So there's no safety concern, but there's still need to scale up on a large scale to reduce the cost of the whole system. In fact, I know that some of the Chinese scientists and in Shanghai, Jiao Tong, for example, they have developed a system that can scale up to 1 ton of this magnesium-based alloy for storing hydrogen. They can transport this in a very mobile way. You can just load it like a big cartridge in a truck, and then you can swap the cartridge for any vehicle application or even for shipping. So this is the future. I think material science and nanotechnology constantly bring up all the exciting frontiers and the breakthroughs that would really push this frontier of hydrogen storage and transport. So I see that in the next 5 to 10 years, the emerging technologies in the new way of producing hydrogen, new way of storing and transport hydrogen, will see hydrogen economy really take off. But that's not all of the energy transition, because we do still need some fossil fuels, because the scale of the energy is so huge. Without cleaner way of using fossil fuels like carbon capture and storage, combining with gasification of coal, that's clean coal technology, without using gas, we cannot satisfy the energy demand of the world. You know?
But are there any capture and storage technologies that are working efficiently? Because usually you ask that question and the answer is no.
I think at the moment there's a lot of a large-scale demonstration. There's no industrial-scale CCS in operation that is economical. So to put it that way, that is still being developed. I think at the same time, renewable energy, for example, solar photovoltaic, solar PV, has become so cheap, and the manufacturing and the scale-up of new generation photovoltaic technologies is also promising to further enhance the efficiency. So that is going to move very rapidly. So at the same time, we still rely on partly in the energy mix in the next 10, 20 years.
But you're saying in your paper that Australia has got the potential to be really the world leader putting these technologies together. Energy could be the name of the game for Oz.
Yeah, absolutely. So I'm excited about the future of energy in Australia, in the energy transition, because Australia is rich in, we're endowed with our energy resources. So therefore, in the next 10 years, in my view, we need 10 years to really, really align things, invest in the R&D, but also make the policy environment more conducive for industry and R&D to really work together to drive this transition so that Australia not only become self-sufficient with the renewable energy, clean energy, but also become an exporter. And in that way, we become a world leader.
There's a huge market here as well, the world leader, as you said. But also in your paper, you talk about the need to coordinate. You know, here we've got a fragmented society. And I'm talking about the world, not just Australia.
Yeah.
You know, fragmentation is the name of the game, and flooding the zone and all the rest of it. So there's more confusion and competition and climate wars and energy wars and all that stuff. What really, if you had the ear of the prime ministers and the leader of the opposition and everyone else on a good day, would you ask them to do?
I would say to really unite the whole country, to really say, well, we want to change our industrial structure. Energy is the bloodline. So we want to be at the forefront developing the renewable energy future. At the same time, we are so fortunate to have so much resources, we can become the leader of technology and export our technology. So in that regard, I would say to any political leaders, prime minister, ministers, that, well, let's work together towards the long-term future. So we need to invest. The ambitious Australia plan, R&D, is a good start. And we need to develop the mechanism to coordinate the approach.
And Wollongong could be the capital of the investment and the revolution.
Yes.
Professor Max Liu, the new Vice-Chancellor at the University of Wollongong.
And there's the Ambitious Australia report again, being mentioned by another notable researcher. A few weeks back, we reported a story about crickets that tended to an injured antenna like a dog might lick a sore paw. Next week, we ask, if insects can indeed feel pain, how does that change how we legally treat them?
I'm Robin Williams.
And I'm Belinda Smith.
You've been listening to an ABC podcast. Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio, and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.